You know, all the sort of work which is done in the home is fundamentally still work. We have to build sort of, you know, these larger networks of care, perhaps starting from the family, but extending far beyond the family. So it's a socialization of childcare, I think, is a really good example of, you know, the sort of the ways in which we can both provide more care and better quality care, and also reduce in aggregate the amount of work that it sort of requires. And I think this is sort of foundational to any sort of better society in terms of the organization of reproductive labor.
Well, guys, hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Dissents podcast. I'm your host, Lukas Ondrejka. We have another episode in English this time because on the program this week, my guest is Nick Srinicek. He's one of the most prominent figures of the post-work left, known for his book Inventing the Future, Post-Capitalism and the World Without Work. In this week's episode, we want to talk about his latest book titled After Work. Nick, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Again, thank you so much. Nick, in your latest book, After Work, you take a closer look at the household, a closer look at all the time we spend with care work and how we can collectively not only share this work more equally, but reduce it as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So your book is firmly within the discourse of post-work. As I said, you're a prominent figure of it, but it kind of fills in some of the blind spots, I think, because we have growing discussion about the reduction of working hours within the sphere of paid work. But what happens after paid work is often overlooked in the debate. And that is what your book is offering, a close look at the sphere of reproduction, especially the unpaid work in our homes, the cooking, the cleaning, the looking after the kids and so on. Mm-hmm. That seems to take up an ever-increasing portion of our lives. Everybody that has kids and struggles with the demands of intensive parenting knows what I'm talking about. And most of us will probably do it in single family homes and the nuclear family, which also puts a lot of demand on the individual. So for starters, Nick, why do you think it's important that we not only take a look at how to work less for our bosses at work, but also take a closer look at how to work less in our homes?
Yeah, so Helen and I decided to write this book when I think it was sort of in the middle of writing Inventing the Future, and it became sort of readily apparent that, you know, reproductive labor was something which was missing from the story of that book. And we ended up having, after discussions with Helen, ended up having, you know, I think a page or something like that on reproductive labor. But it was very much, you know, just a sort of some initial thoughts about how post-work might apply and, you know, how it might not apply to reproductive labor. But yeah, Helen and I decided that, you know, it needed to be the focus of a much larger study, which ended up becoming the book. Helen did a talk on it, I think, back in 2015. And I remember reading it and thinking, oh, this is perfect. You know, let's turn this into a book. And we both sort of optimistically assumed it would take a year or so to do. And then 7 years later, three children and one global pandemic later, we finally got the book out. But I think there's a few reasons why reproductive labor is crucially sort of important. One is simply that it is a core aspect of the gender divide of, you know, things like the gender pay gap, things like the gendered inequalities of free time. The fact that in every single country in the world for which we have data, women have less free time than men on average. So yeah, it's a huge sort of part of the story about gendered inequalities, the role of reproductive labor. And then, of course, there's that long history from, you know, numerous feminists arguing that, of course, the stuff that's done in the home is work, that it's not just something which is sort of done out of a labor of love. It's something which is difficult. It's, you know, it can be boring, it can be messy, it can be endless, it can be repetitive. You know, all this sort of work which is done in the home is fundamentally still work. Mm. And it struck us that, you know, if you want to talk about post-work, you need to also include all these varieties of work, not just wage labor. The other thing, which didn't come to us until a bit later into our research, was simply the sheer scale of the amount of work that's being done that might be considered to be reproductive labor. So I think we're all well aware of, you know, the sort of unwaged aspect of it. And, you know, the stats that we sort of came across and calculated in the book show that for most of the rich countries, it's about 40% of society's working time is unwaged work. And most of that is, you know, reproductive labor. Mm. So a large proportion of our working time in the aggregate, is devoted towards this sort of work. But then crucially, and this is something which I think hasn't been well recognized yet, is that within the wage workplace as well, reproductive labor is a growing part of the labor market. The figures that we calculate show that, you know, over the course of from the 1970s to 2021, I think is the latest year that was available, you go from about 15% of the labor market is doing reproductive work. So things like cooking and cleaning and healthcare and education and stuff like that. And today it's around 30% of the workforce, which is doing this sort of work. So, you know, we used to talk about manufacturing powerhouses in, you know, the 1950s and 1960s. And that was when about 30 to 40% of the workforce was working for manufacturing. Today, it's completely flipped, and we now have that sort of proportion of the population doing reproductive labor. Mm. So this work is crucially important in every sense of the word. You know, it's important for gender inequalities, it's important for the sort of domestic inequalities, it's important for economies in the formal sphere. For all these reasons, if you want to talk about post-work, you have to include this sort of work in the story.
Mm. But one thing that's interesting is that, sure, we can all agree that like in the productive sector, when we go to our alienated jobs or something like that, we can agree that it's a good thing that we move towards post-work or less work. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the reproductive sphere, it's kind of getting more ambivalent, I guess. First, it's not that easy in that sphere to have like productivity gains, for example, through automation. And then it's also the question whether it's desirable to have like humanoid robots that are taking care of our kids and of our elders, mm-hmm. you know. But you specifically say that we have to have a fight against domestic work and not only share it more equitable among gender, for example, or among people, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one of the things we end up having to do in the book is to look at the ways in which post-work ideas themselves have to change when they're talking about reproductive labor. Because reproductive labor is a sort of unique type of labor. As you say, you know, it's difficult to introduce productivity improvements there. You know, things like education, for instance, you can't really increase the speed at which people learn. You know, there's marginal sort of gains that could be had there, but not a lot. Mm. You can, of course, add more people to a classroom in order to get, you know, one teacher being ostensibly more productive. But as you add more people, you know, the quality of the teaching and the quality of the learning tends to go down as well. So it's really difficult to gain any sort of productivity enhancements in a lot of reproductive labor. But then the other crucial thing is that, well, a lot of this work is intimately intertwined with, you know, giving care, giving love, and giving, you know, affection towards others. Mm. So, you know, it's difficult to just simply say that, well, childcare is work. It's a complicated sort of thing because, you know, there are obviously aspects of childcare that are, you know, I would get rid of in a heartbeat. You know, the sort of midnight waking up and, you know, changing nappies. And
yeah, I feel you totally.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, then there's vast amounts of childcare that are also incredibly pleasurable, incredibly enjoyable. And, you know, even when my child wants to do, you know, the same game for the 30th time in the last hour, you know, even that can be enjoyable in its own way. So it's difficult to disentangle, you know, reproductive work from, you know, the work aspects versus the sort of, you know, freely chosen activity aspects of it. And then, yeah, so when you're talking about post-work, it then becomes difficult. You know, are we saying that, yeah, all this work should be taken up by robots? Are we saying that...
Are we saying that we should turn it into wage labor? Yeah. You already mentioned the trend that we see more service and more care work as waged work in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
With the side effects of, for example, racialized over-exploitation we can see.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, is post-work sort of saying that we should just not care as much? You know, should we actually reduce, like, you know, quite literally reduce the amount of care that we're giving? Which is the opposite of the problem that, you know, most people are facing now, is that they have a deficit of care. A lot of people are simply not getting enough care that they need. Mm. So, yeah, when we start trying to, you know, bring these two things together, these ideas of post-work and these ideas about reproductive labor, it becomes very complicated very quickly. And, you know, you start to realize that both of these ideas have to change to sort of reflect each other, to reflect the nuances of reproductive labor and to sort of, you know, adapt to to rethink our conceptions of what post-work might mean, which is what, you know, a big chunk of the book is trying to do, is trying to unpack and disentangle these sorts of things and show how they can work together, really.
Yeah, one kind of interesting thread that weaves through your book is kind of the idea of socialization of housework, of reproductive work, to kind of share the burden more collectively.
Yeah.
I already mentioned that most of us do the housework and care work for elderlies and for children in the single family home and nuclear family, which is also convenient for capitalists and for the state. Mm-hmm. We want to talk about this in more detail because you kind of lay out principles of communal care, public luxury, and temporal sovereignty, which should like govern post-work society when it comes to reproductive labor. But maybe just give us a glimpse, for starters, what that would mean, like the socialization of housework or reproductive work, mm-hmm. in order to free up time for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest example of the socialization of labor is the sort of classic demand of like the 1970s feminist movements, which was 24/7 universal free childcare. You know, childcare available for everybody through all hours of the day to recognize the fact that, you know, people have different working patterns, particularly nowadays, even more so than in the 1970s. So you have to have childcare available at all these times. It has to be available for everyone, so it has to be universal, and it should be free. It should be free at the point of use, you know. Hmm. So these are sort of the basic principles. And then the idea is, well, you can gain some sort of economies of scale here. So you can sort of increase the efficiency of, you know, childcare giving by having, you know, one person look after more children than they normally would. But in my experience, you also get massive benefits from childcare in terms of what the nurseries can provide versus what you as a parent can provide. You know, I'm busy with work. I can't always focus all of my attention on my children. I, you know, they go to the nursery and they do very messy things that I would not want to do in the house. You know, all these sorts of things which they're able to do in the nursery, you know, socializing with other children, playing with other children, learning, you know, how to recognize others and how to learn to be recognized by others. All of these sorts of things which are, you know, absolutely essential to growing into being an independent, autonomous adult. And it's just better provided for in the context of something like a nursery. So it's a socialization of childcare, I think, is a really good example of, you know, the sort of the ways in which we can both provide more care and better quality care and also reduce in aggregate the amount of work that it sort of requires. So this is the sort of thing that, you know, is central to the idea of like socializing and care. Mm.
You already mentioned technologies and the use of technologies to free us from housework. You also kind of tackled the history of the home and the history of technologies within the home in your book. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about what that history of technological reduction of housework entails, like from the dishwasher to the vacuum cleaner, and maybe today to the smart home even? And maybe this history is also ambivalent in the sense that sometimes it kind of frees us from labor, but then it also kind of brings in more a rising standard. For instance, since we have our son, like a 1-year-old, we bought like a battery-driven vacuum cleaner because we were so fed up with like the cable-based one. And it's so much easier to take this one and clean up the stuff that he makes messy. Mm-hmm. But in the end, sometimes I think it leads to more work because it's easier to take it and I don't have to think twice. So I engage more with housework instead of leisure time. So it's kind of this trade-off there with technology.
No, I think that's a great example because, you know, if you didn't have that sort of cordless vacuum, you'd probably just let the mess sit there for a bit longer and, you know, you wouldn't be cleaning as often. But the ease of use is increases the standards there.
Yeah.
And we sort of start the book off by looking at technology and domestic technology because when you think about post-work, technology seems like the obvious answer, at least within waged work. You know, let's fully automate the factories and then we'll just spend our you know, have all this free time to do what we want in an ideal world. When we look at the home, though, it's not that simple. Sort of core to a lot of our argument is what's known as Cohen's paradox. And this is named after the historian Ruth Swartz Cohen, who in the 1970s, her and a few other people started looking at the impact of domestic technologies that emerged in the early 20th century. So there was, in her words, an industrial revolution of the home. Mm. And I think this is really important to note because the home in the 1800s is very different from the home in the 1900s in the sort of the Western world. You get the emergence of all these technologies. You get things like, you know, running water and sewers and electricity and gas. And then you get the devices on top of that. You get stoves and fridges and freezers and washers and dryers and vacuums and all these technologies. And you would expect, given that all of these things are supposed to be labor-saving technologies, that the amount of work that was done in the home would decrease dramatically. What Cohen and others find, though, is that the housewives of the 1970s are, in fact, doing about the same work, in fact, more work in the home than they were in the 1900s.
Okay.
So it's this really curious paradox of, like, all this labor-saving technology has come about, but it doesn't seem to be saving any labor. And so they start to look into why this is the case, and it's really crucial for thinking about, you know, the potentials of technology to liberate us from the drudgery of the home. And the reasons why are, as you mentioned, you know, standards is a crucial one. So I think laundry is one of my favorite examples, where laundry used to be like a sort of a monthly thing. You know, it would take all day. It was physically incredibly difficult, but you would do it like once a month. Whereas nowadays, and I've got three children, and I swear my washer and dryer is just running all the time.
We just bought a dryer.
Yeah. Trying to stay on top of the laundry in a household of five is it's incredible. But yeah, the very ease of being able to wash clothes means that the expectation is that you'll be washing them and keeping them clean and keeping them pristine. Mm-hmm. So the technology actually enables that sort of raising up of standards, along with, of course, you know, detergent manufacturers advertising and, you know, presenting, particularly from the 1930s onwards, presenting this image of like the clean home and personal hygiene and all the sort of standards that we take for granted nowadays around these things are really built up at that point in time through advertising, but also through scientific discourses and through sort of particular sort of modes of class distinction as well. So the unwashed masses, for instance, being the working class. And if you want to get out of the working class, you have to, of course, be clean and respectable and all these things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, technology can save labor, but it's then sort of, you know, taken away by these increase in standards, which are driven by a variety of things. The other thing, though, is that this work was also sort of shifted from being collectively done. You might have done laundry as part of the local neighborhood. You might have all done it together and sort of shared the labor. And then with the washer and dryer, it means you can do it in the home. And eventually that work gets delegated to a single housewife, that one person taking care of work, which was previously collectively done. So again, that sort of reduces the labor-saving impact of the technology. And then lastly, there's the fact that these technologies can also introduce new tasks and new amounts of work. So things like, you know, the fridge and the freezer, they're great. So for instance, you can cook a load of food at the beginning of the week and then have leftovers and store it and keep it, and, you know, it doesn't go bad. But then in order to sort of, you know, make use of all this stuff, you also need to drive your car to a grocery store, get the food, you know, do all these sorts of things, which I think is starting to change with e-commerce. And I think this is one of the interesting stories we try and pull out. But at its peak, shopping would take about 8 hours per week of the average household's time, which is not an insignificant amount of time that's spent, you know, just driving and shopping and picking out things. Mm. You know, I can distinctly remember as a kid, for instance, the weekends, Saturday was devoted to going around driving, doing errands. You know, it was getting groceries, it was picking up whatever we needed for the house. That was just a whole day devoted to that sort of thing. It sort of disappeared now, I think, but it was quite a significant amount of time. But yeah, so for all these reasons, effectively, it means that the labor-saving technology that was involved with the Industrial Revolution of the home didn't save all that much labor. And that sort of then spurs us to think on in the rest of the book about, well, how can we save labor? How can we reduce it without necessarily, you know, returning to the great unwashed masses? Mm.
Yeah, we want to talk about recollectivization or communal care later on, but maybe when it comes to technology, and of course, technology is not neutral. There's also capitalist interest in marketing certain technologies, in raising expectations when it comes to cleanliness, for example, in the household. And also, don't forget planned obsolescence. Yeah, we have to shop for new technology because the vacuum cleaner that I bought just now, one of the parts is already broken. So it's not made durable. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to technology, you also kind of examine what one could call domestic proletarian innovations in technology. So is there, when we look at technology, kind of a socialist reappropriation of technology when it comes to labor saving in the household?
Yeah. Part of the story here is that, yeah, the domestic technologies that we do have tend to be, let's say, constrained by capitalist interests. There is, for instance, you know, genuine labor-saving opportunities from something like a dishwasher. But what we find is a series of sort of examples of where the full sort of labor-saving capacity is sort of taken away because it might be too expensive to manufacture, for instance. And, you know, there's cheaper versions available, and those do better on the market and stuff like that. So there's, you know, a series of sort of decisions that are oriented around, you know, cutting costs and maximizing profit, that end up meaning we don't get the full potential of the technologies we might have. And then as an alternative, we also look at various sort of, you know, more bottom-up approaches. And I think one of my favorite examples, which isn't necessarily solely related to domestic technologies, but is the Lucas Plan, which is Lucas Aerospace. I think it was the 1970s in the UK. They were an aerospace company which made effectively weaponry for the military. They were about to be shut down due to some government cuts to the budget. And the workers decided, well, instead of shutting down the factory, what we'll do is we'll collectively work together, figure out the sorts of skills we have, the technologies we have at hand, and we'll create a massive list of all the things that we could potentially build which are socially useful. Mm. So not building weapons, but instead building things like, you know, they were building, I think, things like solar heating for collective buildings at the time. You know, this wonderful sort of moment of like proletarians basically saying, here's what we could build. Let's just give us the opportunity. And yeah, it didn't end up working in the end because of, you know, power struggles and things like that. But there is, I think, a lot of different examples to draw from about basically workers designing their own technologies that are take into account the needs of workers first and foremost, and that aren't oriented towards just simply cutting costs to improve the bottom line. Mm. And I think, you know, there's really good examples from Dolores Hayden. Dolores Hayden about various sort of utopian communities where women in these communities are often given access to a lot of resources and given the space to sort of think about and develop and, you know, build new technologies for their own sort of domestic purposes. And she can rattle off just pages and pages of these little innovations and big innovations and all these technologies, which are simply designed by these workers in order to make their jobs easier. I think it's a really good example of, you know, the potential that sort of gets lost. And then there's one of our favorite examples is a woman, I think her name was Frances Gabe, if I remember correctly, but she was absolutely despised housework and despised it to the point where she created her own home that was self-cleaning. So effectively turned her house into like a dishwasher.
Yeah, it's kind of like these public toilets where you get out and then they flood everything on the inside.
Yeah, exactly. That sort of thing. Yeah. So the whole house could be washed that way. It was all sort of waterproof and like, you know, the things that needed to be protected could be protected from the water. And yeah, it was designed to minimize housework as much as possible. And, you know, she just built it herself out of pure, you know, spite against housework, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, I actually found a video of her and the prototype home that she built on YouTube. I'm going to link that in the show notes. Check it out, guys.
Yeah. So yeah, we sort of look at all these examples and say, well, there's a lot of capacity for innovation when you let workers who know the job and know the tasks involved, let them actually design labor-saving technologies themselves. There's a lot of potential there. And so that's one of the things we sort of suggest is, you know, giving more opportunities, giving more resources to allow this to happen.
Speaking of workers, Nick, the fight for free time is of course connected to the workers' movement. The reduction of the working day is crucial there. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the household and care work, the dominant parts of the workers' movement, which were historically and in many cases still are dominated by men, often had or have no regard for the gender divisions of work there. So I wondered, Nick, if you could tell us a bit more about radical feminist critiques within the labor movement, mm-hmm. and also tell us a bit more about anti-housework visionaries, where you think that their ideas are worth drawing upon today when we are sketching a path towards like free time for all.
Yeah, so you go back to like the earliest periods of the labor movement sort of pushing for the reduction of working time, you know, the sort of classic 8 hours for what we will, you know, 40-hour work week sort of movements. And what you find is, yeah, they're highly male dominated, which is to be expected. You know, the waged workforce was male dominated at the time. And you have this real division of spheres between men who sort of do this, you know, it might be a 10-hour job a day. So they're doing 10 hours in the workforce, coming home. And then for the men, there's this real separation, like a physical separation between the space of work and the space of leisure and relaxation in the home. Women, by contrast, don't have that physical separation whatsoever. And in fact, they don't have the temporal separation either. Mm. So the home is just their constant workplace. It's not easily divided between a space of work and a space of leisure and relaxation. And the work, of course, of social reproduction is something which can occupy any hour of the day. You know, there's always something to be done, particularly when you have younger children around. And so men sort of locked onto the household as a space of relaxation and leisure, and women never really had that, you know, that sort of possibility. And then gets played out in the sort of the politics of free time, where, you know, men are struggling for a shorter working week, but there's no real discussion of, again, the work of the home. There's some feminists at the time who are really trying to argue and point out, you know, this sort of stuff. And we found some interesting examples from like the early cooperative movements, for instance. So women in the cooperative movements, for instance, are going to the male leaders of these co-ops and being like, give us some money so we can buy industrialized reproductive technologies like industrial laundries and industrial, you know, cooking machines and things like this. And the men just basically being like, what? Why would we do that? You know, just completely ignorant of the possibilities here and the fact that this was work. Mm. Now, that does sort of change a little bit, I think, as we move into like the 20th century. There's, you know, there's early periods during the Russian Revolution and the sort of thinkers around there. What I think is quite interesting, though, in this period of the Russian Revolution, when they're thinking about, you know, the socialization of housework, the freedom of women from the tyranny of the house, the argument why they want to do this is not for more free time. It's because they want women to move into the workforce and become part of this industrial workforce that's going to, you know, build the new communist future. There's not really an anti-work sentiment there. There's a sort of functionalist argument that we need to move people out of the home and into public industry. That's effectively it. Mm. So again, there's like, you know, there's a lot of inspiration, I think, to be drawn from these thinkers, but we have to also recognize the limits of their own perspective as well. It's fundamentally not anti-work. And then I think you sort of get the, you know, the wages for housework, which is actually wages against housework, more properly speaking. Mm. You get that sort of movement and the thinkers around it who really take the anti-work stuff and then push it in to a feminist perspective, arguing for, you know, the collectivization of this work, but also interestingly arguing for the use of technologies to reduce this reproductive labor as well. And then, yeah, sort of, I would say a lot of this stuff tends to get lost then, but Kathy Weeks is probably the most notable recent proponent of like post-work from a feminist, you know, anti-reproductive labor perspective. Mm. Her work is absolutely fantastic. It's been really inspirational for Helen and I in terms of thinking about how do these two things go together. But yeah, there's lots of inspiration to draw from. And we try and, you know, incorporate it all into the book and sort of show that there is this sort of subterranean history of thinkers about anti-work and reproductive politics.
Yeah, I guess one important part of this feminist critique of the gender divisions of labor is also the critique of the family, the nuclear family. Mm-hmm. That's a feminist critique that argues that the family as an institution of privatized care overburdens individuals and exploits caregivers, still today mostly women. You engage in your book with Helen with this feminist critique, and you also give room to authors who propose family abolition as a solution to those problems, a demand that one could say causes heated debate. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can talk a bit more about the problem of the family, how the family is an obstacle to a world in which we have more free time and the necessary labor is shared more equally, and how could socializing this work or family abolition actually look like?
Yeah. So yeah, family abolition. I think it's interesting. It's a very provocative term, and I think somewhat intentionally so. But you know, there's a variety of arguments that sort of stem from this idea about why the family should be abolished. I think absolutely core to it, though, is the idea that the provision of care. So caring for children, caring for elderly parents, caring for, you know, adults with long-term care needs, that the provision of care should not just be limited to the family. I think this is the absolutely sort of core of the family abolition argument, is that care is actually something which is better provided collectively. Mm-hmm. You know, as Sophie Lewis, one of the most articulate proponents of family abolition, points out, you know, we have this common saying about it takes a village to raise a child. But of course, in practice, if you ever suggest something like that, people look at you very strangely. And, you know, if you talk about it in terms of family abolition, you're suddenly, you know, this pariah. But I think taking away the sort of provocative elements of family abolition, I think there's a lot there that's worth engaging with. And in our book, we engage in particular in terms of the amount of work that's required. And we point in particular to the domestic inequalities of time that are pervasive. Not only is it that women have less free time, but the quality of their free time tends to be worse as well. So, for instance, they tend to have more interruptions, they tend to have shorter periods of free time. You know, they tend to, when they're ostensibly having free time, they're also got half an eye on the child in the corner, you know, making sure that they're safe. You know, all these things that mean the quality of free time is also suffering as well. And then beyond that, there's also the sort of ridiculous duplication of effort that's entailed by having single families do these same things over and over again. So, you know, Ruth Swartz Cohen again points out the sort of absurdity of having every single household in a nation, you know, cooking food on, you know, the domestic technologies that they're not even using that night, every one of them sort of duplicating this effort of cooking food, wasting energy, wasting food, wasting time. There are much better ways that this could all be done. So yeah, this is sort of fundamental for us to the critique of the family. It's just that in terms of the provision of reproductive labor, including care work, it's just not very efficient. And it's not very good in many cases. If you have a family which cares for you and looks after you and you care about your family, that's a relatively, you know, small group of people. I would wager even the minority of people who have a family like that. In most cases, you know, there's loads of people who are estranged from their family. There's loads of people who are in sort of, you know, long-term arguments with their siblings or with their parents. There's loads of parents who treat their children horribly. And there's loads of children who then can't or won't look after their parents when they're older. The family is not, you know, it shouldn't be the sole means through which we provide care as a society. And so the argument then becomes, well, you know, family abolition suggests that we should have no families, which I don't think is the way we should go about it. But family abolition is suggesting that we should expand the provision of care and not just limit it to the family. And I think this is sort of foundational to any sort of better society in terms of the organization of reproductive labor.
Mm. Nick, we talked a lot about communalizing and socializing care as a way forward and what that actually could look like. And I mentioned that in your book, you propose kind of three principles that can guide us in our struggle for a post-work future, and communalizing or socializing care is one key principle. Mm-hmm. The other two are public luxury and temporal sovereignty. So I wondered if we can talk a bit more about those. Public luxury, I found that quite interesting that you propose public luxury. We already talked in this podcast about the concept. Because in earlier works of yours, you proposed universal basic income as a solution to inequality. And public luxury seems to go kind of in a different direction, a more collective one. So maybe you can talk a bit more about what you mean by public luxury. Mm-hmm. And the third one, temporal sovereignty, for our German listeners, Zeitsouveränität. So yeah, maybe elaborate a bit how, besides communalizing care work, those two principles, public luxury and temporal sovereignty, can also guide us in our struggle for post-capitalist and post-work future.
Yeah, so I think communal care we've sort of already discussed, and I think the sort of foundational aspect of it is to point to the fact that, A, the family is not a particularly good way to provide care in society, but B, there are much more sort of efficient ways to do this sort of thing. Ways which, you know, waste less time, less resources. In the case of cooking, waste less food, enable us to provide higher quality care. So again, the example of sort of nurseries and things like that. Communal care is just saying, you know, we need to build these sorts of institutions which allow us to spread the work of reproductive labor around in a more equitable manner, but also in a way which is in aggregate more efficient. Mm. The second aspect then is public luxury. And public luxury is pointing to the need to sort of make a lot of what we do in our leisure time more freely available, higher quality. You know, so it's not just a matter of like, well, we have all this free time and then we sort of individually sit in front of a TV and, you know, buy things off Amazon and stuff like that, but instead allowing us to sort of have these rich collective lives. So public luxuries, you know, pointing to things like high quality public housing, high quality public transportation. We point to a history of like, you know, these luxurious public pools in America, for instance, pools which were large enough to have, you know, 10,000 people surrounded by parks and things like that. All these sorts of things, which then allow us to, you know, to have a life outside of work, which is meaningful, rich, enjoyable, pleasurable, and it is not fundamentally required to be commodified, which is, you know, there's a long history sort of critiquing like free time is just being, you know, well, it's the flip side of capitalists, you know, capitalists need you to go and consume things as well as producing things. So yeah, public luxury is part and parcel of that. The third one then is temporal sovereignty, which I think is probably not the best name for it, but it sort of emerged from this particular problem we came across of standards. So standards of cleanliness, standards of hygiene, standards of like how clean is your house, standards of how much work are you putting into your children is a particularly prevalent recent one. We came to the problem of, well, how do you respond to this? And you can sort of on an individual level say, okay, I'm going to step out of it. You know, I'm just not going to follow these standards. The problem is that these things have real impacts on people. You know, there's social sanctioning involved if you step outside these standards. If you don't meet, you know, standards of personal hygiene, or if your house is not as clean as it's supposed to be, and particularly with intensive parenting nowadays, if you're not spending all that time on your kids, are they going to suffer later in life because of that? You know, there's a real impact to just sort of individually stepping away from these standards. So temporal sovereignty sort of responds to this issue and argues that what we need is sort of the collective control over these sorts of norms which are governing our lives. You know, some sort of collective deliberation about them. So in the case of intensive parenting, for instance, one of the main findings in the research is that this is driven by vastly unequal societies. So the more unequal a country is, the more likely it is to have intensive parenting. And it makes sense that, you know, in an unequal society where very few succeed, you want your child to succeed, you will spend as much time trying to get them into the best education, the best school, and therefore the best chance at a good job, which provides, hopefully, a decent life. So it's a rational sort of series of steps. But yeah, so, you know, the temporal sovereignty would be thinking, well, you know, let's undermine the drivers of that sort of demand. Let's think about moving towards a much more equal society as a way to undermine the things which are driving this push for intensive parenting. But again, that can't be done on an individual level. It has to be done on a collective level. So the argument is that we need to build these sorts of institutions for thinking about how we organize these norms around reproductive labor. And then I think one of the more interesting arguments we try and make at the end is that in a properly post-capitalist society, we're actually sort of faced for the first time with like competing values. Under capitalism, it's just all, you know, is effectively organized by the market and sort of, you know, there's little spaces for alternative values to emerge. But fundamentally, you know, the organization of society is driven by the values of the capitalist mode of production. Mm. Under post-capitalism, we don't have that sort of fundamental driver. And so you end up with a space of you actually have to negotiate between different values. And we end up positioning post-work as, you know, just one value amongst others. And we try and point to ways in which, you know, the values of post-work, of reducing the amount of necessary labor time that's required for human society, that might conflict with other equally important values we might hold. So things like decarbonizing society and, you know, the sustainability of future societies, or, you know, having autonomy over your work. So, you know, do you want to delegate it to a robot or do you want to continue to have some autonomy over this sort of stuff? And yeah, there's all these questions which emerge in a properly post-capitalist society. And we can't, from our position, you know, determine the answer to these sorts of things. They have to be collectively determined by some sort of future society. But I think it's important to recognize that there is, you know, post-capitalism properly means having to negotiate between conflicting values in a way that we've never had to do before as a human society. So yeah, we need institutions to account for that sort of thing.
It's good that you mentioned the environment and climate change or decarbonization, because what I missed a little bit in the book of Helen Hester and yours is the problem of climate change, the ecology, and global justice in this case. Mm-hmm. Because I saw you in the past always like kind of, you wrote a manifesto on accelerationism. I saw you always as this productivist, techno-optimist lefty who kind of wants fully automated luxury communism. And now we are like getting deep into the climate crisis. And we, for the past couple of decades, we kind of realized that there are certain limits to what we as humans can produce and consume, at least if we as progressive think of it in a globally just way. So of course we could like produce all these humanoid robots like to clean our houses, but it's highly doubtable that this is going to be globally just if we do that in the global north. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about these trade-offs that we face with regards to ecological limits?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the project we set out in the book is a universal one. And I think the project of, you know, trying to build freedom, it has to be fundamentally universal. Otherwise, it's a project of domination. You know, it's a project of the global north dominating global south effectively, or, you know, some other sort of hierarchy of men dominating women, that sort of thing. Those aren't projects of freedom. You know, the freedom of the wealthy classes to be able to buy the labor of the working classes is not freedom. It's a project of domination fundamentally. So I think, you know, any project which is oriented towards freedom, which I think Helen and I's work is and my work has been, has to be universal. Otherwise, it's contradictory. But I think, you know, it gets to the point when we talk about climate change, I think it gets to the issue I pointed out with these sort of institutions that need to be built to deal with conflicting values. And climate change is the perfect example, simply because, you know, it's very easy to imagine a situation where we might have, you know, a fantastic new technology which can do all the labor in the home, and it's also environmentally quite devastating. And, you know, under capitalism, the answer will just be what's profitable. And that sort of question is completely out of our hands to have any real meaningful say over. Under post-capitalism, it's different, though. You know, it's no longer just up to the centers of capitalist power to be able to determine what sort of technologies get developed and what technologies get applied. It becomes fundamentally a collective question. Now, I think, you know, the really interesting way to approach it is to say that there is no sort of a priori answer about these sorts of questions. I think the real way that it might be answered is to say, you know, maybe this collective society in the future might determine that actually the environmental costs are worth it. And that would be up to, you know, the sort of future society to be able to say. Or they might say that the environmental costs are too much and actually we'll continue to do all this domestic work. We can't sort of say in advance. But yeah, the absence of being able to answer the question now doesn't mean that we can't think about the sorts of institutions that might be required and might be necessary to be able to sort of meaningfully resolve these tensions. And I think they'll inevitably be tensions. I saw a fascinating piece of research a few months ago now about, I think it was the glass industry, and looking at decarbonizing like the glass industry from a post-work perspective. And the conclusion was that if you really want to decarbonize the glass industry, you know, this nitty-gritty detailed analysis of the industry and what was required, if you want to decarbonize it, it requires a lot of work. Like, it requires a lot of labor time. It can't be sort of post-work.
Agriculture is an example as well, if we want to make it not so devastating.
Yeah, like, yeah.
And it also requires more work.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's all these sorts of large questions, which given the certain technological conditions we have at the moment, you know, have to be answered in one way or the other. I think on the flip side, you know, technology changes, and one of the reasons I find optimism in technology is because it enables new things. It makes new opportunities available. It gives us more spaces to do things that might not have been possible beforehand, which I think is, you know, the sort of more pessimistic degrowth perspectives, I think, tend to not acknowledge that, you know, the fact that what we can do can change, that the environmental impacts of things can change, and that, you know, what might be sort of environmentally impossible at the moment might become environmentally possible in the future. So I think we have to have this sort of openness and flexibility to conditions changing as well. But for me, you know, fundamentally, if we don't have a sustainable future, we don't have a future at all. You know, it's a sort of foundational condition of thinking about any sort of future, is that it is, you know, one which is habitable for humans. So for me, you know, climate change absolutely has to be at the core of any sort of post-capitalist thinking, and has to be have a huge priority in terms of the values that we're trying to choose between different things. You know, if post-work ended up being opposed to a habitable world, then, well, post-work's got to go. I don't think it's, you know, that mutually exclusive, but, you know, there are tensions undoubtedly between everything.
Yeah, tensions that are ground for ongoing debate, I guess. But yeah, I found it quite interesting that in your book with Helen Hester, After Work, there's no mention actually of UBI, of universal basic income. And there's this shift towards more collective solutions like communalizing care work, public luxury, and temporal sovereignty, which was also only democratically decided upon. So, and I think these kind of principles are much more in line with climate and ecological justice. So, yeah, I found that quite nice and quite interesting. But Nick, we have to wrap it up. So just one last question regarding strategy. Mm-hmm. So because it's, of course, important to have a vision where we want to go, and I would subscribe to the principles of communalizing care, of public luxury, and of temporal sovereignty. But how do we actually get there? That's also an important question. And who is breaking with capitalism now? Because make no mistake, under capitalism, such a future is not possible. So when we think about that, what would be necessary in your eyes to bring about a post-work future?
Yeah, it's always the really tough question of how you actually achieve these ideas. When Helen and I were writing the book, you know, we came to this question inevitably. There's a couple of ways you could think about presenting an alternative. One is like the sort of idealistic blueprint for an alternative society where every single sort of mechanism is already set out in advance and you've sort of detailed all the things that are interconnected. Or you could do, which is, I think, really common in books, which is a few sort of, you know, tinkerings on the edge of current society in order to try and make, things slightly better. What we ended up trying to do was to say, well, we want principles, which is, you know, the three principles, communal care, public luxury, temporal sovereignty. We want these principles to be able to guide both immediate actions, which are available right now, and long-term horizons. So, you know, if the government comes along and says, we want to do this to childcare, can, you know, according to these principles, is this a step in the right direction or is this something which should be resisted? You know, it gives us guidelines for trying to understand how to get from point A to point B without trying to set in advance, like, how that actually is achieved, which is, it's going to be different in every single country. You know, that being said, I think one of the most important things for the left today to do is to think about how we bring in the new working classes in terms of low-wage service workers in particular, these people who are typically providing reproductive labor. This is, you know, as argued earlier, it's about 30% of the workforce. It's a dominant part of the labor market at the moment. And it is typically the most precarious part, you know, extremely low paid, extremely high turnover, loads of, you know, poor working conditions, lots of exploitation. And it intermingles with, you know, gender, with race, with, you know, citizenship, all these sorts of things which need to be accounted for, and then sort of, you know, recognizing the ways in which these divisions can be breached and sort of brought together. And I think the left, far too much of the left, still has, you know, an idea of the working class as blue collar manufacturing work. It just isn't the case anymore, at least in, you know, the advanced capitalist countries. So this is the new working class. This is the reality of the situation. I think people like Gabriel Winnett, for instance, his book "The Next Shift" has really, you know, made this clear as well. How do we organize? You know, how does this group organize itself? How do we, as you know, somebody like myself, how can I help? But you know, recognizing the realities of the changed labor market, thinking about different ways of organizing it, and then thinking about the ways in which the sort of cross sector interests can be brought together. And I think post-work can be one of them. You know, I think that sort of general hatred of work is something which can be found amongst a load of workers. So, you know, these sorts of things are ways in which we might build the sort of collective identities, the organizational structures, and the collective projects that are, you know, orienting these groups to try and transform our world. Will it happen? I don't know. But I think, you know, the first point is simply recognizing the changed realities of the working class today.
Nick, I want to thank you for taking the time to be on my show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ja, ihr Lieben, das war's. Das war der Dissens-Podcast für diese Woche. Wenn ihr euch für Nick Srinicek oder seine Arbeiten interessiert, dann schaut doch mal in die Shownotes, da habe ich alles Wissenswerte verlinkt. Ich hoffe, die Folge hat euch gefallen. Ich mache ja nicht alle Tage Folgen auf Englisch. Erstens, weil, glaube ich, mein eigenes Englisch ein Graus ist für alle Menschen, die uns hier zuhören. Und zweitens, weil dieser Podcast sich natürlich auch in erster Linie an ein deutschsprachiges Publikum richtet und in die deutschsprachige Debatte intervenieren will. Aber ich halte es dann doch auch mal für wichtig, mit manchen DenkerInnen aus dem englischsprachigen Raum in Kontakt zu kommen. Und Nick war jemand, den ich schon lange in den Podcast einladen wollte. Genau, und wenn ihr dazu eine starke Meinung habt, wenn ihr das sehr gut findet oder eher bescheiden, dass hier bei Dissens ab und an auch englischsprachige Folgen laufen, dann lasst mich das doch gerne wissen. Schreibt mir auf Steady oder schreibt mir eine Mail. Ja, und vergesst bitte auch nicht, damit ich Dissens weiterhin für alle da draußen kostenlos machen kann, bin ich auf euren Support angewiesen. Erzählt möglichst vielen Leuten von diesem Podcast hier, hinterlasst positive Bewertungen auf den Plattformen und wenn ihr könnt, dann werdet doch Fördermitglied. Gut, das war's dann auch von mir soweit. Bleibt nur noch zu sagen, danke euch fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.